It's Bigler's World. Bum, 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 for the next hour. And I got all kinds of kids' magazines over here. What do I got? Some National Geographic Kids. What am I going to do? Some highlights here eventually. Let's start with Time Magazine for Kids. And this article entitled, Ready for Love. Sarah Johnson wrote this. Charlotte Liebling calls herself a world watcher. She observes the world around her. Here's an example. Liebling volunteered in a store. It sold secondhand goods. She watched people bringing in items to donate. Some of those were stuffed toys. Liebling could tell that the toys had sentimental value, so she felt sad when they were sold cheaply or put in the dog toy section. Sometimes they were just thrown away. One night, when she got home from work, Liebling started doing research. She realized this wasn't happening only in her town. Worldwide, she learned millions of stuffed toys end up in landfills every year. Liebling stayed up late. She wrote ideas on sticky notes. She posted them on her walls. And this is her talking. She recalls thinking, if we can change the perception that stuffed toys lose their value once they've been loved, then we can show people they have so much left in them and give them to others. That's how the Loved Before Toy Adoption Agency began. Here's how it works. People can donate toys through the mail or by taking them to a drop-off point in the United Kingdom. Oh, I didn't know that's where that was. That's where the company's based. Liebling plans to expand to the United States soon. The original owner writes down the name of the toy and a story about it. This can include the creature's favorite things to do and an adventure it's been on. Liebling and her team like to share what makes the toy unique. They think it helps potential buyers understand its value. Next, the toy is cleaned and photographed. It's packaged with its name and story. Every Monday, toys are posted for adoption on the Loved Before website. The company makes a charitable donation on half of the profit from each sale. Think twice. Loved Before has sold more than 50,000 stuffed toys, but the company's goal is more than that. Oh, yes, here's Liebling with an English accent this time.
Just trying to save some toys from landfills. We're trying to change perceptions.
She explains that Loved Before hopes to teach kids
about the value of loving secondhand things again, in hope that it will go far beyond the idea of teddy bears.
Next on Bigler's World, let's do Earth Day Reads. This article, who put this together? Doesn't say. Are you looking for a book to read for Earth Day? I think we all are. These new books explore the theme of the environment in different ways. The Curse of Eelgrass Bog uses fantasy and magic to make an important point. The secret language of birds takes place in our world, but with fictional characters, and nonfiction books such as The Monarch Effect entertain readers with facts. Which book appeals to you most? Says Christine Fernandez, whom I'm guessing probably wrote this. First off, The Curse of Eelgrass Bog. Ever since her parents embarked on an expedition, Kes Pedrock has struggled to maintain her family's unnatural history museum. Nearby is a marshland called Eelgrass Bog. She feels a strange connection to the place. It's rumored to be home to witches and demons. The Curse of Eelgrass Bog by Mary Averling is for kids who want to read a captivating mystery that involves the supernatural, including a possible witch. Let's see, who did this particular review? By TFK reporter Alexa O. Then there's The Monarch Effect. Have you ever wondered where monarch butterflies go in the winter? I think it's Mexico. What about where they come from? Well, The Monarch Effect by Dana L. Church is sure to answer these questions and more. The book follows the monarch through its transformation from caterpillar to butterfly. You'll learn how monarchs migrate and reproduce, and you'll learn why they're endangered. Readers of all ages will love this book, especially nature lovers. Let's see, Dylan Patel did that one, and they got one more here. The Secret Language of Birds. This book by Lynn Kelly tells the story of Nina. She's a teenager who's fascinated with a strange bird. Nina is determined to understand how the bird communicates. She learns about the bird's language, and readers learn about how the birds talk to one another. Get ready for a journey of discovery. The Secret Language of Birds is perfect for readers who enjoy stories about curious kids and nature's wonders. And it says he, who wrote this one? Abhijay Patluri was the Time for Kid reporter who did that particular one. Okay, I think I heard about this article here, or at least the topic of this. Cicada Spring. Sulcrie Berga wrote this particular article. More than a trillion cicadas are coming to the United States. Two broods of flying insects are coming up from the ground this month. People in the Midwest and Southeast are likely to see them. These people can expect a season of high-pitched buzzing. Let's see, brood, what is this, 19 cicadas? They show up every 13 years. Brood 19 cicadas show up. Wait a minute. Oh, the brood, what is this? Is 13 cicadas. They show up every 17 years. The last time these two broods arrived together was back in 1803, more than 200 years ago. Here's what you need to know about this rare event. First off, what are cicadas? Cicadas are in the same family as stink bugs and bed bugs. For more than a decade, cicadas live underground. When they're mature enough, they make their way out. Let's see, cicadas are unusual because of their long lifespan. They don't live very long after they're out of the ground. Once they emerge, they have only 4 to 6 weeks to mate, and then they die. Periodical cicadas are about an inch long. They are identified by their orange vein wings. They have big red eyes. There are 7 different species. 3 of these species surface every 17 years. The other 4 emerge every 13 years. Most cicadas show up right on time, but sometimes they count the years wrong. For instance, thousands of cicadas emerged in the year 2000, 4 years ahead of schedule. Here's what to expect. Cicadas will be seen across several states, probably only 2 states, Illinois and Indiana, will get to see both broods. See, brood 13 might appear in Iowa, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Brood 19 might be seen in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Kentucky. There's a lot of them. Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, North and South Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Virginia. Look around. Do you live in one of the 15 states expecting cicadas this year? If so, how many can you spot? Bring your badminton racket. The male cicada's mating call is a loud buzz, which is lovely. Many people find it annoying. But cicadas are harmless to humans. They don't sting or bite. Insect impact. The Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, is a government agency. It monitors and protects the environment. The EPA says cicadas have a positive impact on plants and animals. They're a great food source for birds, such as hawks. They picture one here. And they're nutritious for the soil as they decompose. Cicadas aren't harmful to flowers or fruit. They only eat sap from trees and shrubs. Female cicadas can damage a young tree if they lay their eggs in its branches. To protect trees, the EPA suggests covering them in netting. Cicada Safari is a website. It was created by Mount St. Joseph University in Ohio. The site suggests wrapping a tree branch with cheesecloth. This will help keep the cicadas away. Okay, let's do one more article from Time Magazine for Kids. Creative Crabs is the name of this article by Shay Mounds. It goes like this. Plastic is everywhere. About 2,000 garbage trucks worth of plastic waste is dumped into oceans, rivers, and lakes each day. That's according to the United Nations. There's plastic at the bottom of the ocean. There's plastic at the top of Mount Everest. Now, plastic has been found in another unlikely place, the backs of hermit crabs. They're using it as shells. This was published in a study in February in the journal Science of the Total Environment. Who is this? Zuzano Jagiello is a biologist at the University of Warsaw in Poland. She is the study's lead author, and she says, "For me, a hermit crab is in a plastic shell, could be the icon of our times."
Jago told Time for Kids. They don't have homes, so they use rubbish.
Jago studies the Anthropocene Age. That's the geologic age we're in now. It's the period where human activity has made a big impact on the environment. Hermit crabs using plastic waste as shells is one example of this. New homes. Hermit crabs are small. They have soft bodies and live near oceans. For protection, they typically wear seashells. They find shells left behind by dead sea snails. But according to February's study, at least 386 hermit crabs have been documented wearing garbage. There are 16 species of hermit crabs that live on land. 10 species were seen wearing trash. Nearly 9 out of every 10 of those crabs were wearing plastic waste, such as bottle caps. The others wore glass or metal, such as broken light bulbs or soda cans. Jagiolo and her team saw photos online of hermit crabs wearing garbage, and they decided to conduct research. Temporary housing. Crabs wear seashells to protect their soft body from predators in this picture here. Recently, they've been seen wearing human-made objects. See, I don't know what that is. It looks like something at the end of a hose that hermit crab's wearing. The researchers scanned the internet for photos of hermit crabs wearing trash. They found photos from all over the world. Some were from scientists. Some were from nature photographers. Many were from people who were just curious. So what does it mean? Scientists aren't sure why hermit crabs are choosing litter instead of snail shells, but they have theories. That's what scientists are. They're theoretical. Some sea snail populations are declining. It's possible that hermit crabs can't find enough seashells. It's also possible that crabs choose plastic because it's light and easy to carry, or they're drawn to flashy colors. Scientists agree that plastic pollution harms wildlife and habitats, but it isn't clear that the crabs are in any danger. Who is this? Oh, this is Jeglo again. She says, "It is really amazing example of beautiful adaptation. What are the long-term consequences of these adaptations? We don't know." To study hermit crabs, researchers used iEcology, or Internet Ecology. It's a way of doing research. It uses information on the Internet to spot patterns in the natural world. For this study, researchers looked at photos of hermit crabs that people had posted online. iEcology isn't perfect. The data can be biased. For example, people are more likely to take and post a photo of a hermit crab in a plastic shell than in a snail shell, because it's more surprising. Okay, let's move to another publication altogether here. We got a little highlights for children. This article called Tulips. They were wildflowers, then they became wildly popular. About 1,000 years ago, travelers in the mountains of Central Asia spotted some beautiful wildflowers. They brought them home to Turkey and Iran, and gardeners started cultivating them. The flowers became known as tulips. When tulips arrived in Western Europe about 400 years ago, probably on trading ships, people in Holland were fascinated. The most valuable tulips had streaks of color like flames. Rich merchants collected them to show off. The rarest tulips became so expensive that in 1637, one famous bulb was offered for the same price as a large house in Amsterdam. People soon realized how outrageous this was and started to lose interest. The prices quickly dropped. But people continued to enjoy the flowers. Today, tulips with names like Pretty Princess or Daydream Cover, cover fields, hundreds of fields in Holland. Visitors come from all over the world to Holland's tulip festivals and flower parades. Of course, you don't have to travel that far to see tulips. You can plant them in your own backyard. Next article here, Books for Belonging. Emmy Kim inspires kindness through the power of reading. Emmy Kim, age 11, noticed that her school library didn't have many books with characters who look like her, so she decided to change that. Through bake sales and lemonade stands, Emmy raises money to buy and donate books that reflect a wider range of people so everyone can feel included. How does your project promote kindness? Let's see. Is this a question and answer? I don't even know what it is. We are sometimes afraid that we don't know, So that's probably a reason some people are unkind to those who are different from them. Books are an accessible way to meet new people and learn about cultures. My hope is that kids reading these books will embrace our differences. Next question. Have your fundraisers done well? Well, at our first one, we raised $762 and purchased 15 books for 5 different schools. This group includes books by and about Pacific Islanders, Asian Americans, African Americans, Indigenous people, and Latinos and Hispanic Americans. At our second one, we raised over $3,000 and donated books about kids with disabilities and different family structures. This group has 21 books, and we donated a set to 12 different schools. How do you choose the books? I do research by reading library books or by watching YouTube read alouds. From the first group, one of my favorite is Eyes That Kiss in the Corners. It's about an Asian girl who realizes her eyes are different from her friends and embraces that. From the second group, one of my favorites is A Kind of Spark. The main character is neurodivergent, like me, and I also like the storyline. So Emmy sells, these are the things she sells, sparkling pineapple lemonade, cookies, guava juice, huapia cupcakes, mochi, whatever that is, and sensory slime. let's see here. What's this article called? 5 questions for a bug scientist. This is sticking with highlights for children, by the way. Dr. Sammy Ramsey studies bees and other insects to keep our planet buzzing. The first question they ask, Dr. Sammy Ramsey, when did you become interested in insects? And he says, well, I was around 7 years old. I was always the smallest kid in my class. Seeing that bugs were tiny, but doing all these cool and complicated things helped me connect with them. Why should we care about insects? Well, about 3/4 of the animals on this planet are insects, and they're so important to our ecosystem. A big part of my work is trying to keep bees healthy. When bugs get sick, you can't perform surgery. You have to get creative about how to treat them. What do you love about your job? Well, no day is the same as another. One day I might be working with bee eggs, and the next day I might be trying to keep a colony of lacewings alive. My work on bees takes me around the world, to Peru, Thailand, Australia, Vietnam. I can't get bored. How can we help bees? Well, I work with honeybees, but there are 20,000 other kinds of bees in the world. All bees need the same things we do: food and a place to live. Planting wildflowers or leaving lawns a little wild can help. One patch of flowers can feed thousands of pollinators. And finally, what would you say to kids who are afraid of bugs? Well, I was afraid of bugs when I was a kid. I thought bugs woke up in the morning thinking, how can I ruin Sammy's day? I worked through my fear by learning and reading about insects. I realized that a lot of things I was afraid of weren't real. Bugs are just out there looking for food, looking for friends, and trying to build things. It's cool to see what they can do. And let's do one more article here. In highlights on Bigler's World. This one's entitled, Ever Wonder? How does food get moldy? Well, that's Mary, age 9, wants to know, how does food get moldy? Well, if certain foods aren't eaten fast enough, molds may say, finders keepers, and claim the snack. But what exactly are molds, and how do they grow on our grub? Molds are a type of fungus, a simple living thing that's neither a plant nor an animal. They need the right food, temperature, and amount of air and water to grow. When you look at a patch of mold, you're looking at a big group or colony of super tiny mushroom-shaped structures. Like plants, they have roots that can extend into whatever they're growing on. They also have a stalk. And at the top of the stalk, they grow and release spores, a type of cell. The spores spread by traveling over air or water, And when one lands on something that gives it what it needs to live, it takes root and multiplies, growing a new colony. There are ways to prevent mold growth. Molds often develop more slowly in cold temperatures, so many fresh foods can last longer if kept in a fridge. Freezing food blocks mold growth. And since molds needs moisture, dehydration or dried out foods like raisins and jerky can stay mold free for a while too. Very high heat kills many mold spores before they get a chance to grow. By cooking foods and then sealing out air, companies can package frozen and canned foods that won't spoil as fast as fresh ones, as long as they're kept in their sealed containers. Mold spores can be unhealthy. So if you do spot moldy chow, avoid eating or sniffing it. Sometimes the moldy part can be removed and the rest is okay to eat. But always ask an adult how to handle moldy food. Mold isn't all bad news. No, 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 no. Some foods, like certain cheeses, are made with edible molds. And in the natural world, mold helps things break down or decompose so that their nutrients can be used again. But in general, you'll want to keep mold away from you and your snacks. Okay, let's go to a completely different periodical here. Science News Explorers. They got good stuff there. What is this article here? You're too distracted, it says. Here's why that matters and what to do about it. Better screen time, sleep, diet, and exercise habits can help you take back your focus. Allison Pierce Stevens wrote this article. I have a confession, says Allison Pierce Stevens. Every time I sat down to work on this article, I got distracted. The dogs wanted attention, so I petted them. My phone would ding, then a text came in, so I got up to check. I was tired, so I took a nap, and I might have gotten sucked into some extended time scrolling through Instagram. It was remarkably difficult to focus on writing about distractions because, well, I was too busy being distracted. Distraction is a tricky thing. Often we don't feel like we're distracted. In fact, we think we're paying attention, often to multiple things at once. But science has shown that we aren't truly capable of multitasking. Our brains evolved to stay focused on one or two things at a time. When we multitask, our brains actually quickly switch from one task to another. It feels seamless, but it's not. It comes with major consequences for our ability to pay attention and think deeply about things. I'm hardly alone in being easily distracted. People generally have become more distracted than ever before. But don't despair. There are steps we all can take to reduce distractions and boost focus. These include changes in screen time, sleep, diet, and exercise. Making a few changes can make you a safe driver. They can also make you more attentive friend and even help you do better in school. First off, they got here, set new screen habits. For many of us, phones are one of the biggest distractors in our lives, and that's no accident. Our phones have trained us to be on constant alert, says Gloria Mark. She studies digital distraction at the University of California, Irvine. She says, we pick up our phones when we see them. Try it sometimes. Walk by your phone without checking it. How hard is it to leave the phone untouched? That pull to constantly check for notifications isn't accidental. The people who create social media software use algorithms to figure out when to send those little reminders. Mark explains, notifications can distract us because they use information to elicit emotional responses. We can't help but respond when an ad or notification brings out an emotion in us, like surprise or fear. That is why it's so hard to resist checking for new content. A recent survey found that adults check their phones about 58 times a day. Many of those checks are just for a few seconds. Still, they add up in a big way. That's because it takes time for our brains to return to what we were doing before the interruption. That delay can have a real impact on how well we focus on the next task. For people old enough to drive, such distractions are downright dangerous. One in three teens admits to using their phone while driving. Eyes that are on the phone aren't looking at the road. and this slows reaction times. In fact, texting teen drivers are 23 times as likely to crash as their non-messaging peers. That's according to the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. But that's not just when you're behind the wheel that phone distractions can have serious impacts. Who is this? Tyun Cybers. He studies social media and teen behavior at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. He says, social media can be super fun. Checking your social media can also make it tricky to focus on the important stuff like schoolwork, he notes. Imagine you're super focused on a project with a great idea for what to do next. Then your friend sends you a funny video. When you get back to the assignment, you've lost track of what you're doing. Cybers says, it takes a while to get back into the work, and you might forget some of your good ideas. That's a pretty heavy accent that guy has. In one 2022 study, 383 7th and 8th graders, Cybers found a strong link between social media use and how distracted people felt. Teens in the study installed an app on their phones. Several times a day, the app prompted them to answer questions. These focused on social media use and distraction during the previous hour. Teens who reported spending more time on social media said they generally were more distracted. What's more, teens reported feeling less distracted at times of day when they were not using social media. As they spent more time on their phones, their distraction climbed. That was true for a whopping 83% of participants. Curiously, teens who used social media the most said they felt less distracted. It's probably not that they were less distracted, more likely that they didn't recognize distractions for what they were, Cybers says. They might not even realize that messages from social media are distractions because they're using it so much. Newton. Need help overcoming temptations of social media? Turn off notifications, Cybers says, or just turn off your phone. Is the off button too much? Put your phone in a different room while you work, or put it in a glove box while you're driving. If you're spending too much time on, say, TikTok or YouTube, you can delete the app from your phone, he adds, and only use it on the computer. One last suggestion, get rid of the mindset that you have to be available around the clock. Let your friends know that you'll not always be able to respond right away. That will make it easier to limit how often you check in. Next section here, get up and move. Get up and move. Personal devices can affect our attention in indirect ways, too. For instance, they can make it harder to fall asleep. Smartphone and computer screens emit blue light, which prevents the brain from releasing melatonin. That's a hormone that makes us sleepy. And the lack of sleep makes us more easily distracted. When we sleep at night, the fluid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord washes over these organs. It removes chemical wastes that build up in them during the day. We also go through different stages of sleep. These stages allow our brain to make sense of information we encountered the previous day. We need both the cleaning and the full setup of sleep cycles to function fully the next day. For teens, that usually means about 9 hours of sleep, though few get that much. Not getting enough leaves us cranky, groggy, which can make it harder to pay attention. One obvious solution is to put screens away earlier and get more sleep. Another is to increase the amount of exercise we get. Exercise improves the quality of our sleep, and it's good for our bodies. But who is this? Peter Gropel. He's a sports psychologist at the University of Vienna in Austria. He says, but being physically active, even for a short time, is also good for the mind. He and Wolfgang Alterman, they set out to see if certain types of exercise were better at boosting attention. They worked with 80 high school students, ages 15 to 18. Each was randomly assigned to one of four groups. One group did endurance exercises, another did strength training, a third group did exercises that required coordination, like walking on a balance beam. The last group read a book instead of doing exercises. Before their sessions, each student completed an attention test, which involved searching for specific patterns on papers full of letters. They then spent 25 minutes doing assigned activities. At the end of the session, everyone repeated the attention test. The reading group did no better on the second test, but all three exercise groups improved. It didn't matter which exercise they did, their improvement was the same. Exercise, Gruppel says, brings more oxygen into the brain. This is helpful for thinking clearly. In the long run, keeping your body active also helps to develop the brain structures necessary for paying attention. Attention! A single session of exercise can improve our ability to focus. Longer exercise programs provide even more powerful effects. One 2020 study found that 3 months of regular exercise improved teens' ability to navigate a maze and to separate patterns. The teens also showed better impulse control, measured by their ability to correctly read the name of a color when it was written in a different color. Bottom line, Gruppel says, regular exercise is highly beneficial for cognitive brain development, and that helps us stay focused longer. The food connection. You might not think it matters, but what you eat plays a big role in brain function. That's why eating a balanced diet can boost focus. A good diet contains plenty of fiber and protein with limited sugars and fats. Carbohydrates, sugars, and starches, such as whole grains, are an important part of our diet. They're especially important for our brains, which run on the sugar glucose. A steady supply of glucose helps the brain stay on task. But many people, especially kids and teens, eat too many refined carbs. These include the sugars found in soft drinks, candy, cookies, and other desserts. It also includes the refined flour used in many baked goods. Chowing down on refined carbs gives the brain a sudden flood of energy. Once it's been used up, we tend to crash, making it hard to focus. But it's not just sugar that causes problems with attention. Some food dyes can, too. Food dyes give candies and fruit drinks. I'm getting all mixed up here. I think I've been having too many of these. It gives them their bright colors. They're found in other types of foods as well, notes Mark Miller. He's a pediatrician at California's Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment in Oakland. Miller and the toxicologists he works with study substances to determine if they are harmful to people or the environment. In 2022, Miller was part of a team that reviewed past research on whether food dyes could impact kids' behavior. The researchers found strong evidence that synthetic or human-made food dyes can cause attention issues in kids. These were not dyes derived from plants. After consuming synthetic dyes, some kids had a harder time staying focused. Not all the kids did, though. Who is this? Miller says, you're more likely to be more sensitive to the effect of food dyes if you have this certain underlying genetic factor. That risk is in the form of a gene that alters the effect of histamine, one of the chemicals that the brain cells use to talk to each other. Some synthetic food dyes increase brain cells' release of histamine. For some people, that's okay. After these chemicals have sent their messages to a new neuron in the brain, an enzyme breaks them down. But in people with a specific form of one gene, the enzyme that breaks down histamine works too slowly. That lets the chemical stick around too long. This chemical is signals its message over and over again, and the result can be hyperactivity and high levels of distraction. Food dyes that make us more distracted also make it harder to learn. So avoiding these dyes can go a long way to improving focus, at least in sensitive people. Miller's research was part of what the state of California used last October to justify a new ban on red dye number 3. It will go into effect January of 2027. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is considering a ban as well. There's some evidence that other dyes, including red number 40 and yellow number 5, may cause similar problems, but clearly it will be years before all troublesome food dyes are removed from grocery store shelves. Until then, you can help protect your ability to focus by checking ingredient lists on food packaging. Food dyes are usually listed at the end with a color and number. You're likely to find them in brightly colored foods, including cookies, candy, drinks, even yogurt. If you have trouble with distraction, consider limiting your intake of foods that contain those problem dyes and replace sugary foods with more complex carbohydrates, such as whole grains or fruit. The combination should power your brain for longer, allowing you to keep your focus throughout the day. Add in some changes in phone use, sleep, and a bit of exercise, and you've got yourself a recipe to reduce the distractions in your life. Okay, next article here, sticking with Science News Explorers. They got an explainer here. They like to explain things. I guess that's what they do. What is the solar cycle? Roughly every 11 years, the sun goes from a quiet period to one full of solar flares. Totally cool. Adam Mann wrote this article. The sun is the closest star to Earth that gives all Earthlings, especially astronomers, a front row seat to its activities. One of the most striking features of the sun's activity is what astronomers call the solar cycle. This is an epic rise and fall in the sun's level of activity that repeats every 11 years or so. Astronomers owe the discovery of the solar cycle to sunspots. Ever since Galileo first pointed a telescope at the sun in 1610, people have witnessed the occasional emergence of these dark blotches, splotches, on the sun. As the sun rotates, completing one spin every 27 days, those spots appear to move across the star's surface. Heinrich Schwab regularly tracked sunspots from 1826 to 1843. This German astronomer is credited with discovering that sunspots frequently tend to vary every 11 years. During the most active time, or maximum, of this 11-year cycle, dozens of sunspots can be seen slowly crossing the sun at a time. At the least active point in the solar cycle, the solar minimum, our star may be sunspot-free. Over the years, research has linked sunspots and the solar cycle to the sun's magnetic field. Much like Earth, the sun has a magnetic field with a north pole and south pole, but the sun's magnetic field is at least 100 times as strong as Earth. It's also much larger and more complex. That mysterious magnetic field, the sun is a huge ball of super hot gas. Temperatures within the sun are so high that electrons get ripped away from the cores or nuclei of their atoms. This creates a swarm of negatively charged electrons and positively charged nuclei. Such charged particles are known as ions. As ions move around inside the sun, they create swirling magnetic fields. Those fields twist and turn, churning as the sun rotates. Sometimes magnetic field lines come together and create points with extra powerful magnetism. At the sun's surface, those spots of intense magnetism cool off the surrounding gas, making the sunspots appear. The overall surface of the sun roils at what is 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Sunspots look so dark because they are much cooler, only around 6,300 degrees Fahrenheit. The sun's powerful magnetic field affects much more than the star's surface. In fact, our sun's magnetic field is so strong that it reaches beyond the orbits of all the planets in the solar system. As a result, it can influence the movement of charged particles as much as 75 to 100 times as far from the sun as the Earth is. No one fully understands how the sun's messy, intense magnetic field works, but astronomers do know that during each 11-year solar cycle, the magnetic field's poles switch, which has been the sun's magnetic north pole becomes the south pole and vice versa. During the next solar cycle, the poles will switch back again. The switching of the sun's poles doesn't affect us much on Earth, but other events tied to the solar cycle do. Why solar activity matters. As the sun approaches solar maximum, it can release powerful bursts of radiation from its surface. These outbursts are called solar flares, and they occur when magnetic field lines coming out of the sun become too twisted. Like a rubber band that breaks when it's pulled too far, the twisted magnetic field lines snap, producing more than a million times the energy of a volcanic explosion. Flares travel outward at the speed of light, arriving at Earth 8 minutes later. A different type of burst, known as a coronal mass ejection, or CME, is an explosion at the sun's surface. CMEs hurl charged particles out into space. Their material can take 1 to 3 days to reach Earth. Like solar flares, CMEs are more common closer to solar maximum, but they can occur even during the sun's supposedly quiet periods. Tracking the solar cycle is important because flares and CMEs play a role in space weather. As they hit Earth's magnetic field, flares and CMEs can trigger beautiful auroras in the sky near Earth's north and south poles. But not all their impacts are pretty. In fact, some can be quite harmful. The charged particles and other types of radiation in solar flares and CMEs can disrupt radio signals. They can also damage satellites orbiting Earth and put astronauts in danger. To avoid exposure to these energetic blasts, astronauts must get behind specially designed shields in time. I did not know that. That's crazy stuff. A powerful space weather storm called the Carrington Event showed just how dangerous CMEs can be. It occurred in 1859, shortly after Schwab discovered the solar cycle. In that case, an extremely powerful CME caused widespread damage to power lines and telegraph wires on the ground. It even lit some telegraph stations on fire. Scientists studied the solar cycle to help predict when such events might occur. If a CME as strong as the Carrington event happened today, it would likely knock out parts of the power grid. It could also damage satellites that make GPS systems work. Such a space weather disaster would also likely disrupt phone and internet service across the globe. Studying the solar cycle. In 2018, NASA launched the Parker Solar Probe. The spacecraft was designed to get close to the sun and study its outer layers. 2 years later, the European Space Agency launched its own spacecraft, Solar Orbiter, to do similar research. Together, the spacecraft are getting data about the sun as it moves through the solar cycle. Those data should help improve the computer models and predict when hazardous flares and CMEs might threaten Earth. One of the Solar Orbiter's first discoveries was a phenomenon similar to solar flares called campfires. The sun is now in its 25th solar cycle since astronomers started gathering accurate sunspot data more than 250 years ago. Solar cycle 25 started in 2019 and will continue roughly through 2030. Solar maximum and the peak of sunspot frequency are expected in 2025. Some solar cycles have more active solar maxima than others. Solar cycle 25 was originally predicted to have a relatively weak maximum, but in the lead-up to solar maximum, some spot numbers have been much higher than expected. The number of solar flares and CMEs has been surprisingly high, too. During a total solar eclipse, like the one yesterday, April 8th, 2024, the moon blocks out the sun's bright disk for several minutes. At that time, our star's outer atmosphere, or corona, briefly becomes visible to human eyes. If a big CME happens at the same time of the eclipse, even casual observers will be able to witness the stunning solar fireworks. Okay, let's do one more article in Science News. What is autism in the explainer section here? What is autism? Autism is not a disease, but a description for a certain type of brain development, says Payal Dar. Who wrote this article? Autism is a neurotype, okay, meaning brain type. The term describes how the nervous system, especially the brain, has developed in some people. It affects how they see, hear, feel, and interact with the world. The formal name for this lifelong condition is Autism Spectrum Disorder, or ASD. However, some experts, including many autistic people, argue that it's not a disorder. Instead, they explain it's just a different and not uncommon type of brain development. By age 8, about 1 in every 36 children will be identified as autistic. That number comes from a 2020 data on U.S. children. A monitoring network collected these numbers for the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. People are very diverse, notes Rakshita Shakar, who lives in Germany. She was an educator who taught autistic children in India. People have different hair types and eye colors. They attain different heights and become good at different things. How human brain develops and functions can vary too. Yet over time, society has labeled only one brain type as normal, Shakar says.
Anybody's brain that worked differently started to be called impaired or deficient, she says.
That included the brains of autistic people. There is no one autistic brain type, but many. Still, there are some differences between autistic and non-autistic brains. For example, certain brain structures are enlarged in autistic children and teens. They may be in adults, too. Scientists are still studying that. Studies have also shown that autistic brains respond differently to stimuli than do non-autistic ones. Autism seems to be mostly genetic. Parents pass down to their children genes that have been linked to this type of brain development. Some research suggests environmental factors may also play some role. However, direct links to such non-genetic factors have not yet been proven. One of those suspicions that vaccines might trigger autism has actually been disproven. What traits tend to show up in autism? Because autism is not an illness, its traits are not symptoms. Instead, they are characteristics that help experts identify autism. Doctors tend to work from expert guidelines. Two major sets of these come from the American Psychiatric Association and the World Health Organization. Some typical autistic traits have to do with, they got a bunch of them here, social communication. People whose brains work in the most common way are described as neurotypical, or NT. Autistic people usually find it hard to communicate with NT people. Why? They can find it hard to recognize their social cues, such as someone is being friendly. They also tend to take things literally. For instance, they may not understand some jokes or the intent of a harmless prank. They can express their feelings differently too, such as happiness or empathy. In some cases, they may feel far more strongly about some event than will an NT person. Some autistic people struggle to make eye contact. They may find it hard to know when it's their turn to speak. Some may find it hard to follow verbal instruction. They feel overwhelmed. Some autistic people can find it hard to phrase what they are thinking. In fact, some may just have other ways of communicating. For example, they may speak with a different rhythm or take longer to form sentences. Some autistic people are non-speaking. They use sign language or other types of communication. Then there's sensory processing. Autistic brains tend to respond to stimuli differently than do NT brains. The autistic brain might be thought of as noisy, that is, it may show heightened responses to sights, sounds, smell, and touch. Let's see, Shakar says, some might be hypersensitive. For instance, autistic people may not like being touched. Some, she says, may even smell colors. Other autistic people might be relatively insensitive. They may not pick up on certain sounds or colors. Some, such as Shakar's son, may even need a lot of pressure on their bodies to feel calm. Some people show patterns of repetitive behavior called stimming. That's S-T-I-M-M-I-N-G. These help stimulate their senses, providing comfort or a way to cope with anxiety. Examples can include rocking back and forth or flapping one's hands. Attention patterns is the next one here. People may describe autistic people as having tunnel vision. A term for this is monotropism. Monotropic brains tend to focus on just one thing at a time.
The autistic brain, when it focuses, it goes deep into the zone,
Shakar explains.
That brain pulls in resources from all sides and puts them all into that one thing.
It is common for autistic people to have special interests, deep and intense passions for certain subjects. They spend a lot of time and focus on these topics. In fact, special interests play a big role helping autistic people learn and find well-being. And then there is project planning. The brain manages how we get tasks done. Known as executive function, this helps us cope with novel events or things that change. Executive function helps us manage our time, plan tasks, and make decisions and solve problems, notes Shekhar.
There are huge differences in the executive function of autistic people.
Scientists don't know why yet, she adds, but as a result, some autistic people need a rigid routine to perform daily activities. Others need support in other ways. These traits can vary greatly within the autistic community, so someone may show some traits and not others. What is the autism spectrum? Society often refers to autistic people as being on the spectrum. Many people think this is some scale that goes from less autistic to more. In fact, all autistic people are equally autistic. What differs is how their traits vary. Some people may not even be visibly autistic, but this doesn't make them less autistic. Autistic people have intellectual or physical disabilities related to their brain type. This can be misunderstood as the person being more autistic. They're not. They just have additional issues to cope with. Imagine an autism spectrum as a color wheel. Each color represents a different trait. Each autistic person has a different intensity of that color or trait. For example, one may have good social skills but struggle with executive function. Another may be non-speaking but easily manage daily routines. Depending on their profile, each autistic person may need a different type of support. Some may need help communicating, others help with getting organized, yet others may need assistance with processing sensory data. All of these point to how diverse the autism spectrum is. It's also why experts no longer like describing autistic people as high or low functioning. Such terms don't make sense, says, see if I can pronounce this, Shahansin-si, whatever it is, Sudaresan. She's a psychologist and counselor in Mumbai, India. Function relates to what natural to an individual, she says, so each autistic person functions according to their natural ability. What are some misconceptions? Autism shows up in every culture, every profession, and every age group. Autistic people can be funny or serious, open and friendly, or quiet and withdrawn. Some are even quite famous, like climate activist Greta Thunberg, actor Dan Aykroyd, and Temple Grandin, a scientist and author of many books on autism. The biggest stereotype, says Sundressen, is that autistic people can't make their own decisions. But there are plenty of other stereotypes, she adds, like they can't communicate, they don't have independent thought, and they can't have a very typical day where they can have fun. Some people believe that autistic people can't make friends or will need help 24/7 because they can't do things independently. Another huge misconception, autistic people don't have empathy. We do feel empathy, Sundaresan says, but we express it in a different way. The way we express ourselves overall is different. In fact, she emphasizes, this is the fundamental aspect of autism. Lastly, she and other autistic people note, many people love being autistic. In one 2019 post on social media, Greta Thunberg tweeted, I have Asperger's. That's one term for autism that's no longer used. And Thunberg added, that means I'm sometimes a bit different from the norm. But under the right circumstances, she said, this type of being different is a superpower. Okay, we got a few minutes left here. Let's do some Dogo news for kids. Ba-dum-bump. This article entitled, Antarctica's Famous Penguin Post Office is Hiring for the Summer. Okay, wait a minute. Marcella Bonnet wrote this article. The United Kingdom, or UK, Antarctic Heritage Trust is looking to hire 5 people. A base leader, a shop manager, and 3 general assistants to work at the Penguin Post Office in Port Lockroy, Antarctica. The 5-month stint is open to UK residents over the age of 18. It will begin in early November 2024 and last until March of 2025. Responsibilities will include sorting over the 80,000 letters and postcards sent by the 18,000 tourists who visit the world's southernmost post office each summer. Employees will also help sell postage stamps, run the small on-site gift shop, and look after the aging building. But their most important duty will be to keep track of Port Lockroy's colony of about 1,500 Gen 2 penguins. Exciting as it may sound, the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust warns applicants that the jobs are not for the faint of heart. Even during summer, temperatures on the icy continent can dip as low as 23 degrees Fahrenheit. Additionally, the five people will live in a single bedroom with a tiny gas-powered kitchen. There is no flushing toilet either. Instead, staffers will use a camping toilet, which must be emptied daily. There is limited phone and internet access and no running water. Visiting ships provide water in jerry cans and also offer staffers showers every few days. But in poor weather conditions, they may have to do without a shower for extended periods. With the closest capital in Argentina, medical evacuations could take up to a week. However, the biggest challenge will be the smell of penguin poop that will engulf them for 5 months. Despite these drawbacks, the positions, which open up every summer, receive thousands of applications each year. Camilla Nicole, the Trust's CEO, is not surprised. She believes that for the right individuals, the jobs provide a unique opportunity to live in a landscape that makes you feel pure awe and wonder, and where pioneering generations have gone before us, making groundbreaking discoveries about our planet. Mwah. Mwah. And with that, I am out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.